This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The final jobs report of 2019 came out this past Friday and has some mixed reviews on it. And here joining us is Mark Hamrick, Bankrate.com Senior Economic Analyst. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Newell. Happy New Year.
Same to you. So what did the jobs report reveal?
Well, a lot of things. I think, first of all, we can be thankful that the economic expansion is continuing this far along in its path. We think about the fact that in December of 2018, just over a year ago, there were great concerns, and they were grounded in, you know, legitimate basis that a recession might be developing sooner rather than later. A lot of things happened since then. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates three times. As we know, the U.S. and China basically declared a ceasefire in the trade war. Looks like Brexit will be handled perhaps with not quite as violently as many had feared, and the expansion has continued. So in the jobs report, we saw that 145,000 jobs were added on the month. The average for the past 3 months, 184,000. All of that certainly well above the level we need to keep pace with growth in the population to keep the unemployment rate stable, and that's what we've had. The jobless rate still at 3.5%, matching a 50-year low.
That in and of itself is, really shocking as a statistic. In light of a bunch of things that have happened domestically, where we continue to have this trade war issue going on, the reinvention of NAFTA still not passed, and a lot of other political pressures that still create some uncertainty.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to one of my colleagues who works for another part of our company who covers the airline industry, and he was telling me this morning apparently earnings from Delta were quite solid, and they're seeing basically a strong consumer from both the leisure and business side. And I joke that people are still buying airline tickets and drinking kombucha despite the political fractiousness here in Washington, D.C., which, is all around us, and it's not restricted to Washington. So I do think there is a kind of aspect of that which is remarkable, and maybe that speaks to the steadfastness of the American public, which, is able to ignore, all the noise that does exist out there. I mean, consumers are going to continue to do their thing for as long as the job market enables them to do that, and I think that's what we're seeing.
I always kind of watch the retail trade, and a lot of closings announced again leading into 2020. There's really a lot of constriction being exhibited by a number of major retail outlets. Where do we see this ending? Is that days going to be days past these?
It's not ending anytime soon. With Macy's and Pier 1 being at the top of the store closings list, in the last couple of weeks. And the other thing, Newell, figures on store openings are quite interesting, because in the top tier of, let's say, the five names of stores that have opened in the past year, I believe three of them are in the dollar store format. One of them is a cannabis related name. I think that tells us a lot about where we are in the retail environment these days. And, some of it is obviously the migration to online sales. It's in many ways a much more efficient, effective process with a lower profit margin. And, there's a Macy's near where I live, and I tend to probably go in there almost every Saturday along with the rest of the mall just to kind of make my rounds and see what's going on in there and elsewhere. And, you know, you could basically shoot a cannon in there, right? And and they have, you know, loads and loads of unsold merchandise marked way down. And it's quite obvious that Macy's has way too much square footage, way too much inventory. And that means, you know, as the saying goes, you know, they're overstocked. It's got to all got to go. And that's, you know, that's not a great formula for a business plan. And the other thing is the beneficiaries of that, along with consumers, have been sort of the off-price retailers in the TJ Maxx, Marshalls, the Nordstrom Rack categories, where basically, you know, they're taking all the unsold merchandise, marking it down. And here's something that I just really started thinking about the other day is, you know, here we are basically a decade or more past the worst of the financial crisis and Great Recession. Consumers have been conditioned to believe that they should not pay full price, right? And rightfully so, in a sense, because they usually don't have to. And you know, there are certain consumers, whether they're well-heeled, wealthy, or just want to buy a certain quality or brand name, who are willing to pay full price, but most are not. And so, you know, it's hard to see how you resolve that issue, which, again, at the end of the day, great for consumers, but not great if you're an employee of one of these stores that closes in the mall or you're trying to rent the space in the mall.
I guess it's safe to say that in that sector and others, the predominant number of workers in that sector are, you know, just above minimum wage type wage earners. When we look at these numbers a little deeper and we recognize that 44% of the total workforce is basically working for about $10 an hour, do we see that there's the possibility maybe of wages moving up and upticking more? And if not, how dangerous is that for the economy?
Right. Well, I feel like that it's a little like continuing to cheer, and this is relevant in your community, but in the opposite direction. It's a little like continuing to cheer for a team that just never quite gets there, in the sense of hoping for more substantial wage growth. And the pressures are, I think, well known. Globalization is one, the ability to move work not only across the country to a lower priced location or market, but also elsewhere around the world, and then the benefits of technology that can replace labor. And online does play into that a little bit as well. I think the dangers also are fairly obvious, because I think it results in the kind of volatile, for lack of a better word, political environment that we find ourselves in, that seems to be almost more replicating kind of a, dare I say, the South American model than the traditional model that we've come to know in the United States. And so there's the hollowing out of the middle class, you know, those high-paying, ubiquitous manufacturing jobs that used to be the path for many Americans are not only not there, and they are not going to be there, because even if we just take some jobs away from China, well, they just go to the next country on the list. Obviously, some will come here, but it's not, you know, it's not going to be post World War II. So, I'm very concerned about it, and I know that the sort of traditional or consensus thinking on the part of economists is to say that, you know, we've gone through, you know, 150 plus years of industrialization, and technology has always been replacing labor. But it does seem that the combination of technology and globalization now has kind of delivered a different kind of cocktail that in some ways has been more injurious for Americans and their way of life.
There was someone that coined a phrase the other day. I was reading in an article, it's easier to get a job here in the U.S. than it is to get a raise.
Yeah, well said. You know, having said that, I mean, certainly at the beginning of the year, and this sort of reinforces the low wage part of this discussion, is as we did begin the year, a number of states and localities did put minimum wage increases in place. And I believe the latest figures indicated that basically only 2% of the workforce in the United States is covered by the federal minimum wage, because so many states and localities have basically sort of said, well, forget Washington and we're just going to do our own thing. And as we know, in some locations, that's as much as $15 an hour. But, you know, and to some people that feels rich. But, you know, if you're in San Francisco making $15 an hour, good luck, right? And
right.
And same thing over the last couple of weeks where I was doing a TV appearance on one of the cable networks, and much was being made of Taco Bell managers, apparently, at least according to one story, being offered as much as $100,000 a year. And again, first of all, you know that can be a pretty demanding job. In some cases, you're working with, you know, basically entry-level workers that you're having to basically coach and parent in some cases. And so I would argue that, well, you know what, if you're willing to take that job and willing to work that hard, and particularly in some of the more expensive locations of the country to live, then I would say God bless you. So and we know plenty of people who work less hard for much more money than that.
Absolutely. Mark, I always think in context, you know, when I came through college, we always looked at housing starts, stimulating the economy. And when you look at that in relation to a large portion, greater than a third of our workforce, as I just talked about, making $10 an hour, is the housing criteria falling by the wayside?
Meaning what exactly?
You know, when you're looking at economic development, I mean, obviously, for so many years, we would just relax the underwriting criteria for loans.
Right.
We'd create these housing starts. We'd jumpstart the economy. And because of all of the bank failures and stuff, the regulators are in their shop all the time. It's not as easy to do that any longer. And then you look at this workforce and the average yearly earnings of $18,000. That doesn't buy you much of a house.
No, it's a good point, and I think there are a lot of things happening there. Actually, I think the housing market story for this year, barring the unforeseen, should be one of the more positive aspects of the economy, because the experts in the housing market really do say that among some of the primary challenges there is, frankly, just low supply, particularly in new building. And some builders have gotten wise to the notion that, you know what, if you actually build a home at a lower price point, they'll buy it. And obviously, it's a challenge for many young people to either have the sufficient down payment or even just the means to have the monthly payment. And the other part is that home building is still only, you know, well below the peak that we saw in the pre-housing bust era, maybe. We won't see those numbers for quite some time. But whether it's new or existing housing, it's widely understood that there is a shortage of supply of homes for sale. And, you know, eventually young people do get older and many of them will get married and want to raise families. And so I think that even people in the home construction industry will say that while there's a lot of capital being spended to build basically multifamily or apartments and condominiums, that eventually, whether it's Gen Z or millennials, they do come of age and they will not always want to live in the city to be close to entertainment hotspots, because eventually some of those will raise children and they won't want to cart groceries up a flight of stairs. So I think that some of that will naturally progress, but you know, it's only really been since we saw decline in interest rates in the last year that the housing market has moved from being a detractor from U.S. growth very recently to adding to U.S. growth, and that's a positive.
You know, you just talked about something that was very interesting. You know, when the Jenners begin to want to branch out, start a family, they're faced with a challenge of having dual career couples, right, where they're both looking for a job. Who does better in that area in this country? Do you know?
Who does better in what respect?
In being, what geographic areas is it going to be? The urban area, the suburban areas,
sure.
The major metro markets that actually do better at that than others?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is really kind of a tale of two proverbial cities because, you know, we really do. This is another instance of sort of the haves and have-nots, and it's not. I mean, while it may be to some degree neighborhood versus neighborhood, meaning those that are well, financed and those that aren't. But, I mean, we're seeing, you know, sort of this job growth scenario occur in different markets across the country, whether it's, you know, you go from Charlotte to areas around here in Washington, D.C., to some areas around New York and on up to Boston, and then go on across the country to Nashville and then to Austin and then, you know, maybe some areas of Colorado and then west to Phoenix and Scottsdale and Southern California and then up the coast. And, you know, some of those previously hotter markets are beginning to cool off because, frankly, the year-over-year home price increases are just not sustainable. You know, you just cannot have year after year of 5% and 6% when the wages in those markets, to get back to our earlier discussion, just aren't keeping track. And the other part is that to some degree, people in my generation, the boomers, are part of the problem because many are just frankly unwilling to move out of their existing housing stock. Whereas in the past, the younger generation would have sort of followed us and we'd be going to wherever it would be that we're going. But because of this year-over-year price increase issue again, you know, many people are just unwilling to move essentially to a place that's smaller that has an expensive price point, at least in their eyes. So there's a kind of intransigence on the part of homeowners, too, to move and free up that inventory. And so this is a case of sort of, you might say, the richer getting richer and the poor not making as much progress as they would like.
And, of course, you know, when you lead into a new year, everybody talks about what's up and whether or not we're going to go into, you know, some other type of restrictive economy. Your thoughts about 2020?
Well, I think, first of all, there's no recession that's immediately visible. But having said that, one will happen, Newell. It's just a question of when. And the other questions are how deep will it be and how long would it last? And we've had some that were basically no skin off the teeth, so to speak. And then we had the last one that was horrific. And, you know, and we also have to acknowledge that there are communities all across the country or even neighborhoods that really have not participated in the expansion. And there are some that have been, you know, tremendously benefiting. So, you know, I think the watchwords for our audience at Bankrate, and by extension your audience, is, you know, now's the time to make hay while that sun does shine, and that means trying to save for emergencies, save for retirement. If one thinks that they might be predisposed to look for a new job, by all means, you know, get that networking going, because the harder time to achieve all those things, the savings and the networking and the finding of a job, perhaps even at better pay, which is ultimately, you know, the reason many people do take a new job, that's going to be harder if we're in a downturn. And so, you know, think about the fact that it's almost like seizing upon good health. You know, you exercise, you're not going to be able to maybe run 5 miles if you are in the hospital or have the flu.
Absolutely. And by the way, Mark, the sun did shine on us last night, and we did make hay last night.
Congratulations.
At the Mercedes-Benz Superdome.
Absolutely. Congratulations. That's a great success story there.
We always appreciate your time and your insight, most importantly. Thank you so much for joining us today. Mark Hamrick, Bankrate.com Senior Economic Analyst.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back. We want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. We'll continue this conversation. Or back to LSU, or tonight is another presidential debate. Cory Booker drops out. We'll talk about that as well. Give us a shout. We'll be right back.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.